Hello there. I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about Docker, but primarily containerization, because things have moved quite far in the last few months on that, so this is a more generic kind of term for it. So who am I? My name is James Mintram. I run a small indie company in the northeast of England, up in Newcastle. I'm a programmer by trade. I graduated about 2 years ago, year and a half ago. I've built a real-time fantasy football game in the cloud, so that's kind of why I'm here and doing this sort of talk on stuff. I've got a little bit of experience in that. And I guess a key point here as well is I'm a game programmer. I'm not a full-stack web programmer, so my background is in games, not in cloud and stuff. So I guess that helps people relate to the cloud side of stuff from a games perspective. So I'm going to talk about a few things today. As you can see there, what is containerization? So some people think it's, you know, Google putting servers in containers. It's not that at all. What is Docker and how that relates to containerization? How does Docker help? That's, you know, you probably want to know that. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about Flip Sports, which is the game we built last year that currently runs on a cloud infrastructure called GameSpark. So I'm going to do a little sort of what if we did this in Docker, how would that work? And hopefully that will give you some ideas of how Docker is actually useful when used with games and in production. I'm then going to talk about some sort of more generic ideas of, you know, this is a fantasy football game, but how could I use that in, you know, any other type of game, a racing game or, I don't know, Clash of Clans style game or something like that. You know, how would that help me? And then at the end, you know, Docker's great, but there are challenges involved with it and some further reading and stuff, because as I said, this stuff's moving really fast. So you probably, you know, I'm not going to do very much technical stuff today, because you're better off looking at it online and getting the really up-to-date stuff on like news groups and forums and stuff. So what is containerization? So as I said, it's not containers of servers. It's actually a sort of way that you can package software up. So traditionally, if you wanted to write a bit of software for, you know, web development, you'd have all your dependencies and all of that on your local machine. You would then have to install all that on your server and then push your code up and hope that everything works. You would have different kind of environments. So you might be running MySQL on your local machine and Postgres in the cloud or whatever. And that, you know, you can introduce bugs there because these environments aren't identical. Until a couple of years, about three or four years ago, you got the provisioning tools to help you out there. So Chef, Puppet, SaltStack, all that kind of stuff helped with, sort of alleviated some of those problems, but containers have kind of turbocharged that a bit and made it really cool. And they solve that problem by allowing you to wrap all those dependencies up, all that software up, and just put it into a standard format that will run, you know, anywhere that supports containerization of that particular type, so Docker being one. And I guess if you were to sort of use an analogy, they would be a super lightweight virtual machine. So you get a lot of the advantages of virtual machines. You know, people have adopted those en masse, and you know, the sort of containerization offers a similar benefits with a few disadvantages, but you know, there's so many overwhelming advantages that it's kind of taken off. So how is Docker related to containerization? Docker's a few things. It's not just a container. So the three parts that make it up is the container daemon, the container packaging tool, and the support for repository, each of which I'll give a little bit of an overview about. But it's key to remember that Docker isn't just, containerization isn't just Docker, and Docker isn't just containerization. There's a few subtleties there. So the container daemon, which I guess is the closest thing, the container part of Docker, is a piece of software that runs on a machine. And what that does is it takes this standard package that I've talked about that we package up into a standard format, and it will allow you to run them on a machine as if they were essentially a virtual machine, so isolated with a set of resources that it's allowed to use, and it prevents any sort of interference with other containers and other software that's running on that system. It allows, in addition to allowing you to run these things, it's very well running them, but you actually need to interact with them to make them useful. If they're just running in a box, which is, you know, running in the container and you can't interact with it, they're useless. So there's a lot of things that daemon gives you access to. So, you know, you can access through networking, or you can run commands in the container. So it kind of gives you that virtual machine interface into a container to actually make it useful. If you're running a web server in one, for example, you want to be able to expose the port so people can actually access the content in it and make use of the web server itself. So the next part is the packaging system. So how do we actually build these containers? You know, what process is involved in that? And that's what the Docker packaging system does. And it's quite simple. You just use a Docker file, and that's kind of a sort of recipe book, a description on how you want your software to be packaged up and shipped off. Once it is packaged up, like I say, it can be run on anything that runs the Docker daemon. So you don't need to worry about that. You don't need to worry about, you know, in Windows world, DLL hell, for example. You don't need to worry about different versions of libraries when it comes to Ruby or Python. You know, it pulls that all in based on what your Docker file tells it to do. And the great thing about a Docker file is you can build the container locally and run it and test it before you send it out there. And another advantage of this packaging system and the way Docker works, it's got a special file system that works on differentials. So you can actually have, and this is generally how it works, is you'd have a base image that might, I don't know, be Ubuntu, for example, and then you can add stuff on top of that. So what that means is if you were to build a virtual machine image, you'd have to, you know, create an ISO file or something like that, you know, VMD with the Ubuntu system on it and all the other software packages and everything like that every single time you wanted to make a one-line change to a bit of code. With a Docker packaging system, you could change one line of code. It would be smart enough to realize that's the only thing that's changed, and it would kind of add that on top of your base image that you had before and make it really, really, really quick for you to iterate on things and test stuff out. And then the final bit that Docker has, I mean, there's a few more bits, like I've said, as well, that you have to look on the website. They didn't go into this presentation that John's just informed me of today. So check that out. But the final bit for this presentation is a Docker Hub, which is essentially a repository where people can access containers built by other people. It's very easy to use. It comes as part of the command line. So if you are, you know, you decide you want to build a website, for example, you can just fire up one of these, an Apache container with one line, you know, in the command line interface. It'll go away. It'll do everything it needs to, pull all the stuff down, run it, and it'll be there running on your system, and you can access it within a few minutes. And the same for, you know, if you want to run Rabbit or Nginx and stuff, it's very easy to do. If you want to do that with virtual machines, you'd have to go and find, you know, virtual machine images that could be multiple gigabytes each. Download those, fire those up in VirtualBox or whatever, and, you know, you could be there all afternoon, even on a fast internet connection and computer. So development-wise, it's very fast. So as I've said, Dockers versus virtual machines. Containers versus virtual machines, they're much lighter weight, can be started in milliseconds versus launching a virtual machine, which will basically take the amount of time the system requires to boot because you are starting a completely new system in a virtual machine, whereas a Docker container is running within your current system, it's just completely isolated, so it takes as long as it takes to start the program normally. Creating a Docker container, as I said in the packaging stage, is a lot quicker. You're working on a differential file system, so you can stick this into, say, a continuous integration pipeline, or you can iterate locally very fast and get results back, and, you know, you save a lot of disk space and time through that. System resource usage is a lot less. So in a virtual machine, every virtual machine you want to run, so if we wanted, as in the previous slide, Apache, RabbitMQ, and Nginx, if that was your setup, then you'd have to run three virtual machines on your one system, each one taking anywhere up to, you know, a gigabyte of RAM each just to run, totaling 3 gigabytes. Whereas if you were to do that with Docker, you would have essentially the memory that the apps require to run. It would just load into your current kernel, run, and yeah, you could get a lot more running and a lot less. Also, the CPU overhead and stuff involved, again, is a lot less. So it keeps the system responsive when you are running these entire setups. And it's vendor independent as well. You know, a Docker container will work on any host that supports Docker containers, whereas there are some, you know, when it comes to running sort of virtual machines, there are specific proprietary bits in certain virtual machines for running on AWS or Azure, for example, that don't make them so portable. So they're very portable. You can take a Docker container, as I've said. I keep stressing this because it's the, you know, the real the real selling point here and put it on anything. You put it on AWS, Azure, or Google Compute, and it'll just, you know, it'll run as it did on your own machine. And so I'll talk a little bit about, you know, when it comes to development, when you are actually developing using Docker containers, how that helps the development side. I'll also talk about operations, so I'll split that DevOps keyword apart and just talk about each part individually. As they are lightweight, I've said you can run Apache, Redis, Postgres, and RabbitMQ. I've done that before myself, all on my laptop, and it, you know, maybe uses a gig of RAM, and I can develop quite happily with all my tools and get really quick iteration on the same setup that would be running in the internet, you know, in the cloud. So that's really cool, and it removes a lot of issues when it comes to tying up the bits of software together that you might get if you are using substitutes on your local system. So yeah, being able to replicate the production environment is really good, and you know, it removes that excuse it works on my machine, because if it works on your machine, then it's going to work everywhere. Also, staging and development environments are cheap and easy to set up. If you wanted to try a new feature out, you don't have to sort of take some of the, you know, infrastructure that you might have set aside for QA and testing of your main product. You can fire up a separate side project for a day or, you know, a few hours just to test a new feature out. It's not going to interfere with QA. It's not going to interfere with development of the main line. So it means you can, you know, you can try loads of stuff out. You can be innovative and not have to worry about interfering with other stuff. If it doesn't work, tear it down. There you go. It's done. And being able to see the whole environment on your machine, another point I'll stress, makes debugging an order of magnitude easier. You can just stick a breakpoint on something that's broken and look at it. You can, you know, you can trace stuff through your computer using, you know, viewing the IP packets and stuff like that. I'm not that technical myself, but you know, you can get in way down into that, which would be really, really hard if it was actually out in the wild running on all these different machines out there and different services interoperating. So onto the ops side of things, these are guys who you've built the software and now they've got to manage it and deal with the bugs and getting out there and running. Immutable production environments are good. So, you know, you don't have to update your servers. It's better to fire up a new server and tear down the old one instead of changing your environment, because you can introduce errors at every point of a long-running instance, for example. Rolling out and rolling back are greatly simplified. So if you roll out a new update and it turns out it's broken, you can just push new containers out and it will replace the failed release very quickly, thus, you know, reducing disruption to your customers, which is always good. Reproducible deployments, that's something that's very key and people strive for, is the ability for, again, I've got it set up running like this on my system, I need to be able to reproduce that on Azure or Google Compute Cloud or something like that, you know, and it needs to be identical so I know how it works out there is how it works on here, and I can reason about the system. And it integrates well with continuous integration. So if I'm running Jenkins, if I'm running a Jenkins setup, it's very easy to add a Docker stage at the end to actually build that all into a container and test it and put, you know, fully integration tests and unit tests and all that stuff fits very nicely in with the Docker workflow. So you can automate this almost from the outset, which is key, again, to the ops guys and developers. And you can decouple from your infrastructure provider, which has a few advantages on it. So all, you know, Azure, AWS, and Google all support Docker. If one of them goes down, for example, you can, you know, move parts of your infrastructure over very quickly. It's just a case of those, you know, giving them your Docker containers and saying run these. Allows agility, so price fluctuations. You know, if you were a bit adventurous, you could take advantage of, say, a drop in price on one over the other, and you know, get the profits up there. And you can run QA and staging on, say, cheaper but less robust cloud providers that, you know, have like $5 a month virtual machines, but you probably wouldn't want to trust your system critical applications on those. So Flip Sports, then, this is the thing that we built this year, a real-time fantasy football game where all the logic runs on the cloud, currently on GameSparks, and the client is essentially a dumb terminal. So when I say all the logic, I do mean all the logic is on the cloud. And there are lots of moving parts with this, so I'm going to discuss a tiny little bit of that and how we can move that into a microservices architecture. I'll also tell you what microservices mean as well. So that's currently how it works. We receive a blob of data from some provider that tells us how the sports are going, how the stats are. It's real-time fantasy football, so we need to know how each player scores in each match and each team, all that kind of stuff. So it gets given to us, we get a notification of that, we store it, and then we kick off this big monolithic process that does all the, you know, it digests the data, it calculates scores, it then goes through and calculates scores for every team, player team. And then it takes the at the end of the match, it'll calculate scores, resolve challenges. All this is one big massive, unseparable chain of code. And it would be good if we could split that up into these microservices that I'm going to talk about. So having smaller steps, it would increase the flexibility, so we could change a little bit without having to worry about breaking other stuff. If we wanted to change a scoring system or we wanted to, say, support another type of sport, it'd be easy. Less chance of introducing bugs. So if you're composing lots of bits together, then you can test and reason about every individual part separately as opposed to a whole big system that might interact. And we call it microservices. So there's a thing I got off the internet about what microservices are. It's a design pattern where complex systems are decomposed into smaller processes which communicate through a well-defined platform-independent API. And generally that's REST, but you can, I guess, use whatever you want. Things like message queues or whatever would work for as an API. And as I say, developers can debug and test each microservice in isolation, and this fits very well with Docker. In fact, I think Docker even says that's kind of what they envisage Docker containers for being used for. So to redo what we had before, each one of the square boxes would be a microservice. So we have, and this shows how flexible Docker is, we've got ProFTP, which is a completely different bit of software that we've installed in a container, configured to receive files, and then that's just part of our infrastructure. We've not had to write any code or anything like that. We've used a bit of existing software. We've then put it alongside our file ingester, which takes the XML files, processes those into the database. We've then separated out our data processor, which does the grunt, like the bulk of the work, takes all the potentially hundreds of thousands of players and scores and puts that all together, and then dumps that into the blob store. And then finally, we've got the challenge and league management stuff all separated out. So each part is completely separate, communicates through a well-defined API that each one exposes. And I've put a request handler on the end there as well, which is essentially what the client app will talk to the system through. So the really cool thing there is each one of those could potentially use a different language and technology. So you're using the right tool for the right job. Yeah. So ProFTP, I mean, you're not going to write your own FTP server. Use one that's already written and secure. File ingestion, from my experience, Python's really good for processing XML files. So let's use that for that part and stick it in its own little microservice. Data processing, well, Python, we found, wasn't fast enough when working on other stuff. It's the fact it's interpreted and does loads of stuff when using Django, for example. We wanted we'd want something a lot faster than that, so Go is a good example there. You could take the data out of the database, process it, and dump it out, an order of magnitude quicker. And then the user request handling could be in Node.js, which is generally good for handling lots of concurrent connections that aren't doing much at any one point. So yeah, right tool for the right job. You can do that with Docker very easily, and it all works very nicely. Another thing you can do with Docker, because it's so quick and easy to create new instances and tear them down, you can use that to balance your load. So if you get a peak load coming, let's talk about flip sports, for example. If we have a big match, something great happens and you get another 10,000 people log on straight away, you need to handle that load quickly. It doesn't, if it takes 5 minutes to get a new VM fired up, or even 3 minutes, these people are going to time out, their requests are going to start falling over, and they're going to leave, right? So you can quickly shift compute power away from, say, the data processing by tearing down 10-20% of those containers and firing up another 10-20 containers to handle the users. And in that 3 or 4 minutes, you would fire up some more virtual machines, and then you would have the capacity to handle the full lot. So from a user's perspective, what they would see is they would see a degradation in the service in terms of how long it takes for data to come from the screen, the TV, BBC Sports, to their machine. But they won't see any perceivable lag in terms of they want to interact or anything like that. That'll all work at full speed. It's just that the data takes a bit longer to get through, and that's a much better user experience. So that would be something that would be suitable for this case here. Every game would have its own way, but the ability to do that, the ability to sort of be nimble and agile with your infrastructure will create a better user experience overall, which is exactly what you want. So for more typical games, so if we were to sort of broaden that out a bit to other games, you know, how would we use containerization or, you know, microservices and stuff for this? So these are some of the typical things that you might want to do in games nowadays: user management, leaderboards, achievements, and then some more game-specific stuff.
So matchmaking, hosting online games, and, you know, some custom server logic that might be, you know, suitable only for your game. So everyone's familiar with the user management leaderboard stuff, but the game-specific stuff, there's some really cool things that you could do that are really interesting here, and I've got a couple of ideas that I'll share. So the blob store, so a lot of services support the idea that you can have cloud save, and generally it's a blob of data you upload, and it kind of sits there until the client pulls it down on another device, and then works out which one's the newer one, which one do I use, do I keep this, or if I don't know what I'm going to do, I'll ask the user. So you could write an intelligent cloud slave, you know, something that will take a blob of data, but instead of being a blob of data, it knows about it, and it can, you know, so it's very specific to your game, it can interrogate that blob of data, and you could, you know, write cloud code that might say, I don't know, I'm going to send you a push notification in a day if you don't come back, because I know that your thing's going to be ready, or I know this is going to happen, or you can see what they've been doing, you know, so it actually makes it a bit richer. And ordinarily, you know, you couldn't justify, say, writing a whole system for that and then running on a virtual machine, but when we're talking microservices, that would be a very trivial thing to do, kind of roll into an existing setup. And the really cool one that I think is really cool, and I've even said that it's cool, is the ability to run, say, dedicated servers. So these would be services specific to your game, right? So if you're building
an Unreal 4 and you have the option of building a dedicated server out of that sort of package, the engine that you're using, you could wrap that up in a Docker container, and then you could upload that to a cloud service, and you could run these instances. So if I wanted to play against someone else, my opponent, you could spin up a container just for the half an hour that you play the game, and then tear it down at the end, and that's great. So it saves having to have lots of empty capacity sat around. And you don't need to do really any configuration or anything. You know, if you were to use virtual machines, you'd have to build an image and make sure it worked, and every time you updated again, you'd have to rebuild it and upload it and make sure everyone's on the same version. With Docker containers, it's great. You can have it built and uploaded and people using it within 10, 20 minutes, and that's really cool. And you can go even further with that within a microservices kind of idea. You could make your achievements and your leaderboard services available to that. So if you are running a dedicated Unreal server for people, you can make the achievements and the leaderboard services available within that. So instead of my phone saying I've just got an achievement, I could be awarded the achievement within the actual server code itself. So, you know, that kind of, you can get around, I guess, cheating or whatever there, or, you know, it makes it a bit more agile, so all the code and stuff that's related to awarding achievements and leaderboards is in the right place. It's not kind of pushed out onto the client side. So some other advantages, skill set reuse. So if you're running a studio and you want to use microservices with containers, you know, if all the developers on a project use C++, that's great. They can write whatever they want, you know, whatever microservice, whatever sort of added value they want to add to that game, they can write it in C++. And then the ops guys who deploy that and manage that don't have to worry about it, because for them it's just a container that they deal with and place out on the internet and, you know, manage and run. It doesn't matter what's inside it to them. But to the guys who write that stuff, the game team itself, it's great. They can use C++, or if they're Java guys, they can write it in Java. They don't have to reskill the team that are building this stuff. There's also code reuse. You know, if you're building a game in, say, Unity and C#, and you've got a server aspect of the game that has sort of data in it. You know, let's talk about a racing game, or, you know, again, Clash of Clans style game. There's going to be an awful lot of data, and there's going to be complex data structures involved in that. So what have you bought? Where are your enemies or whatever in that data that you need to do stuff on the cloud with? So up till now, I guess you would, you know, a lot of people would rewrite that in whatever language they're using. So if they were, if the web developers all use Python, then you'd have to recreate all that stuff that's already in the game in Python. And then you'd have to make sure it matches up with the C# code and it all gets converted and marshaled properly and all fits together. Whereas if you could just take your a subset of your code, C# code, and then add a bit more code on top of that to make it a microservice, bundle it up, stick it up there, you've reused a lot of code. You've synchronized the data models between your between your client side and your server side, and you save yourself a lot of time and a lot of bugs. You could go even further than that and make it really good if you consider a complex simulation game written in Unity, in C#, that a modern PC could easily handle. The latest SimCity game's got some pretty mad computations behind it from what I read when I was following the development. So that's probably not going to work on a mobile device. It just hasn't got the horsepower to do so. So it'd be great if you could take that PC game and you could, you know, hopefully you've built it in such a way where it's modular and you could take the bit of code out that does a simulation. Again, wrap that up in some more stuff to make it a microservice, package it up, send it online. And then you've got a mobile game that would work similarly, using the same code, the same stuff to render the graphics, but instead of the simulation being done locally, it would be done in the cloud for very little effort. And open source as well, you know, sharing the love. I think soon we'll start seeing more and more people releasing some of the stuff that I've talked about. Some of the, you know, achievements or leaderboards will be available as containers. So you could actually compose your own bespoke kind of cloud system for your whatever game you're building just from pulling a few containers together and then orchestrating them online from other people who've built these, and you know, you can contribute back and create this great little ecosystem. That might happen, it might be a pipe dream, I don't know. So there are some challenges with Docker. It's not all great, and I briefly mentioned their orchestration. So if you've got all these microservices around, you've got to manage them, you've got to orchestrate them. You know, how does one know how to speak to the other? How do they know where they are? What if one falls over? Do I need to bring it back up again? How do I make sure it's spread out all over the place? So if one server goes down, it doesn't take all my game code with it and stuff. Skills, there's a little bit of overhead in terms of, you know, learning how to use Docker, the best way to do it, you know, approaching stuff from different angles. And then the speed of development of the technology, you know, is rapid. So even from 2 months ago when I first started looking at this for this talk, things have changed a lot. You know, I only found out today that there's a whole new thing come out from, you know, being announced from Docker. So, yeah, but they're not insurmountable, and there's some existing solutions to these. The orchestration one, I think, is probably the hardest one that anyone would have to solve, and that's what all of these things here do. We've got Deus, which helps with the orchestration and, you know, the skills. It's very easy to use. We've used it, and I didn't need to learn anything to use it. If you've used Heroku or anything like that, great. Kubernetes, which is more of a, you know, more focused on orchestration. So if you want to build something a bit more in depth, great. It helps you with that. And then Flynn, which I've briefly looked at, and you know, you should take a look at it yourself. And then CoreOS at a much lower level. All the ones above that are built on top of CoreOS. And as I say, things are moving fast. So like we've talked about Docker, there's Ubuntu's LXC, CoreOS has got its own rocket, Docker Swarm, and I've read somewhere that Microsoft are looking to support containers on Windows. So yeah, there's an awful lot to look into and take a good look. Thank you very much.
Thanks, James. Any questions for James?
Great talk, thanks. Why would anyone use virtual machines now? You made so many great points about Docker. How would you characterize situations in which I would have to use a virtual machine instead of Docker?
I think it's mostly a security issue. So the isolation between containers isn't absolute. There are ways to break out of that sandbox. I think that's the key one at the moment. But yeah, apart from that. And also, there's stuff that you can do in virtual machines that you can't do in containers. So I think the way that it's a semi Linux system at the moment, so it's not a complete virtual machine. So for all intents and purposes, the application, it behaves like a virtual machine, but you don't have things like systemd and other bits. That's about as far as my knowledge goes there. But that's the key stuff.
Any other questions? Nope. Thank you, James.